Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Left of Straight Show with your host, Scott Fullerton, as we discuss everything under the rainbow sun, from LGBT issues to foodies, entertainment to books. Join us as we talk to some of the most interesting leaders and celebrity LGBT guests and allies on the internet. So grab a cocktail, it's always happy hour somewhere, and enjoy the show. Now, here's your host, Scott Fullerton.
Well, howdy, everybody. Welcome to the Left of Straight Show. It is Thursday. We made it to our fourth day of the week. I hope you're all having a fantastic day. I hope it feels short. Tomorrow's Friday. We had a Memorial Day weekend, kind of sort of in quarantine. So I hope you're enjoying a short week out there. It is Thursday, May 28th, 2021, our very last week of May. Next week is going to be June already. Of course, I am your host, Scott Fullerton. I appreciate you coming on to the show. Yesterday, we had so much fun. Had another great pop culture minute with our J&J Buzz crew, Jeff and Josh, out of Nashville, Tennessee. Love those boys. And then a couple of great interviews. Ann Walker was supposed to come on first, but had a little trouble with her mic and audio getting in. So we played our interview with Michael Orland first. A lot of great response to Michael. Michael was the vocal coach and musical director for American Idol for 16 seasons and did such a great job. He's also been the musical director for so many amazing Broadway people like Bernadette Peters and Kristen Chenoweth. He's worked with Eric Bergen, who you know I love, so many great people. So we had a fun interview with him. And then we were able to figure out Ann's problem, and she came on live for the second half of the show. We talked about our great Sorted Lives extravaganza this Sunday. I hope you're able to tune in. Our buddy Del Shores, Emerson Collins, have put together with the Del Shores Foundation a live streaming, live reading of the original play by Del Shores, Sorted Lives, featuring the cast from the plays, from the movies, from the television series. They're all going to be there. Leslie Jordan is so hot right now. Caroline Ray, of course, Ann Walker, who was on this week. Newell and Rosemary Alexander, who was on this week. Levi Christ was on this week. And it's just going to be a fun time. Beau Bridges will be back. Olivia Newton-John sending a special message. She can't participate for this one, but she will be back. And it's going to be a great time. They're raising money for 23 theater companies across the country. So please go check it out. They also have an amazing auction. You can actually win items of clothing won by Leslie Jordan in the movie. You can win Whoopi Goldberg's purple schmuck she wore as the minister for a very sordid wedding. So you can find all this on Dell's Foundation page, www.shoresfoundation.org. So head to that. We're hoping to make lots of money for these 22 theater companies across the country. It's been written up in all the major magazines, and it's going to be so much fun. And if you have not seen Leslie Jordan, his brother boy, if you only know him from his Instagram, you are going to be in for a treat watching him portray brother boy the entire way through. It's an amazing feat. So, yeah, be sure to stay tuned. It's 5 o'clock Pacific, 8 o'clock Eastern time on the it's going to be streaming on YouTube, I believe. You can probably find it on Del Shore's page as well. So look for that. Got a great show coming up for you today. In just a couple of minutes here, I'm going to do our mental health minute with Stephanie Schroeder. We're doing those every other Thursday. And she has two great topics today, talking about public health, what is public, the shaming of society on that word, and on homelessness. And in that vein, coming up first, our interview is going to be with actor and producer Mike Manning. You may remember him from The Real World DC. And he has a documentary he's been working on for quite a few years all about youth homelessness. And we know how much that homelessness affects the LGBT youth disproportionately. So we talk about that for a couple seconds. And then we're going to finish up tonight with Ramise Ellis. She is a foodie after my own heart. She has a great Instagram where she posts pictures of food and talks about it. And we talk about how she takes these pictures. It's pretty amazing. And she is now going to be our new special correspondent foodie here on the Leftist Trade Show. So every other Thursday when Stephanie is not on, we are going to have Ramise talking about some aspect of the foodie culture. And I'm very, very excited about that. So great show. If you guys don't know, I also have a new text number. You can now text me on the telephone. It is me. You're getting directly to me. No answering service, no anyone else. It goes directly to me. It's totally free. You have to jump through a hoop to go through. You have to put contact information so I know who you are and that you accept that you know it's coming from me. But other than that, it's real simple to do, totally free back and forth. It's really me. We can talk about anything you want. And I'm going to be using it for a lot of fun things on the show. Like I sent out a message today to text me for, I have two great pre-tape interviews tomorrow. I have one with Glenn North, who is on a fantastic new Bravo show and called, Camp Everything. God, I forget the name of it already. I'll look that up before the end of the show. And I have him. Then I have Tommy Atkins, who is a singer out of Europe, the UK. And so if you have any questions for Glenn or Tommy, text my number. It's 330-249-7857. You may have to put the one in first. And you can text from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Unfortunately, any of my U.K. listeners are outside of the U.S. or Canada. I can't get those texts, but everyone else, send me. We're going to do questions. We're going to have special meet and greets when I do the big gay road trip that's coming up in a few short weeks. So it's a lot of fun. So give me a text, 330-249-7857. You can find it on all my social, and we will have a good time with the texting. I promise not to spam you in all the texting. But let's get ready to jump right to it tonight. We're going to start off here with a mental health minute. These are all pre-taped. I talked to Stephanie. We did hers this morning. Mike Manning, I actually did over Memorial Day weekend, this past weekend. And Ramise, I did earlier this week. So great group of people. I'm going to be pressing buttons and talking in between the shots here. And then I'll come up to finish everything else at the very end. So let's go ahead and take it away with Stephanie Schroeder with today's Mental Health Minute. You're listening to Left of Straight Show right here on the Left of Straight Radio Network. All righty, guys. I am so excited. It's time for our every other week Mental Health Minute by our special correspondent, Stephanie Schroeder, out of New York City, co-editor of the fantastic book Head Case. Stephanie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Scott.
What do we have to talk about this week?
So I wanted to talk about two articles I've read. You know, over the long Memorial Day weekend, I had some time to read longer form articles from magazines and journals. Of course, I read them online. But it's made me think about the way mental health is often discussed as something separate from physical health. But the way I think
right.
about mental health is, you know, in a holistic type of health, like mental health, physical health, and they both have ramifications with each other. But this also includes, for me, being healthy, like not being assaulted by homophobia, by transphobia, racism, misogyny, all those things. It also includes having safe housing, safe and stable housing, enough to eat. You know, I have the luxury of having that, and those are luxuries. But both of those things and many more are out of reach for a lot of people. So, you know, I tend to read about mental health and housing and homelessness. I work in the field of housing and mental health. I live with a mental health issue. I write about mental health and housing. So that's what I read about. That's my interest. I mean, of course, I read other things, but this is what really appeals to me. And I'd like to share two really excellent and important articles I've read recently that I think bear repeating and reading by other people. So the first one is an article that was in the Boston Review on April 1st, 2020. The title is Fighting for Public Health, and it is by Michael Bronski. Michael Bronski is a professor in the practice of media and activism in studies of women, gender, and sexuality at Harvard. He's also the author of A Queer History of the United States. So in this article, he kind of goes through, first, what's his definition of public health, which is the understanding that the health of each group and each individual is fully dependent on the health of all. And that's kind of what I said before, previously, is, you know, everybody, if one person isn't healthy, no one is, you know?
Right.
And then he goes into a little bit of history about public health and kind of settles on the Settlement House movement in the late 1900s. And I worked for Settlement House, which is so interesting, and how women mostly, who were nurses and social workers, helped immigrant communities in a way that was kind of defined as public health, but which never translated into a U.S. policy politically, culturally, anyway, in the concept because of the word social. And it's interesting the way he talks about the word social, like, you know, the specter of socialism, social housing, social policy,
right.
even today, the social option for, you know, healthcare. So, you know, with that being socialism being the big scary thing, it never got adopted.
Well, I thought it was interesting. I mean, you forwarded me the two articles. I really appreciate that. And
Yeah. Also
the public perception of the word public and the connotations there surrounding almost being less than others. I thought it was very interesting the way that he kind of broke both of those down.
Yeah, the way he frames it is really interesting. You know, I mean, there's a whole, you know, masters of public health, public health policy. But what does that even mean? And given the way where we are situated right now, which is in a place where we can't even think, everything's individual. You know, everyone's responsible for their own health, their own insurance, their own medical whatever. And, you know, Bronski, the author of this article, says that's because of decades and decades of right-wing eroding of science and social programs. Again, the word social,
yeah.
Right? And today, according to Bronski, superstition and prejudice prevail, like as we know from the eroding of LGBTQ and other civil rights. Like, you know, we're waiting for this Supreme Court decision that we're all terrified about whether we're protected in employment.
Right.
You know, and I think the commentators think it's not going to be a good outcome for us, which is terrifying for the people in the, whatever, 26, 27, 28 states where there are already no protections. It'll leave them hanging out there.
Including here in Ohio, definitely. I'm right with you.
Yeah,
on that
I mean,
one.
In New York, we're lucky. We have a lot of protections, but, you know, across the country, people don't. And in this article, I guess the conclusion of Bronski's article is that because of the growth and takeover of, you know, right-wing religious and nationalist movements and interests, the U.S. has become super isolationist and anti-sexual, among other all kinds of, you know, I mean, we've seen these horrible incidents of racism in the past couple of days, you know, videos of cops, white cops killing a black man and a white woman calling the cops. You know, it's just like it's endless. So, and this has been encouraged by our current federal administration. So I don't think Bronski comes up with any conclusion, with any solutions, but it's an interesting article in that he takes us through the whole history and why it's not working. And I think leaves it to us, the reader and the public, to kind of draw our own conclusions and maybe take some action. I don't know. So I just thought it was interesting. It's in the Boston Review, bostonreview.net. And again, the title is Fighting for Public Health. It was published on April 1st.
And we'll go ahead and put both these links down in the description of the episode today. So if you're looking for those, go to the Blog Talk site and they'll be able to find those articles because they are very interesting. I really enjoyed them.
Yeah, and the other one I read just over the weekend, it's from The New Yorker, and it's, as New Yorker style is, super long. It's in the June 1st. Print issue, but it was online May 25th, and it's called A Window Onto an American Nightmare. And the subtitle is, As the Homelessness Crisis and the coronavirus crisis converge, what can we learn from One City's struggles? By Nathan Heller. And by One City, he's talking about San Francisco in particular, the framing of his article. And he focuses on San Francisco, of course, but, like, you know, this could be anywhere. And he points this out. It could be New York. It could be Portland. It could be anywhere with a high population of homeless people, which is, are everywhere but are hidden in a lot of places. And he approaches the story from the point of view of both homeless people. Like, we get a flavor of, like, you know, five or six characters who are homeless people. Like, not characters, but, you know, they are of character and draw the picture of, like, how they became homeless, how they're staying homeless, how they got housed, what kind of services they receive, what are their
issues. Right, case studies almost, yeah.
Yeah, really, really interesting little capsule. But more than that, he talks to providers and politicians all over San Francisco, you know, the mayor, her staff, social service providers, other people, one who runs a kind of tough love boot camp at her restaurant for homeless people, and, you know, makes them shave their head and renounce drugs and all kinds of stuff, which leads me to his next conclusion or even just discussion. Everyone thinks their solution is what is the solution for homelessness in America.
Right.
But it's all of these, to me, and working in the homeless services field, in the mental health field, you know, which a lot, mental illness leads to a lot of homelessness. So do a lot of other things, domestic violence, drug use, poverty, the lack of affordable housing. You know, the list goes on and on. But it's not just one of these solutions, you know, because it's not a one-size-fits-all thing. These solutions, these, like, discrete solutions, a list of whatever, 10 of them or whatever, works for some people. It works for a good number of people, one of these, number one, number five, number seven, number 10. But it doesn't
right.
work for all homeless people, you know, and I feel like at least the media writes about the homeless, like the homeless individuals are a monolith, and there's one way to eradicate homelessness. Well, if that were the case, we wouldn't have homelessness, right? So to me, it's about a multitude of things, which is, you know, recognizing why people become homeless and stay homeless, as well as why there is a lack of basic care and resources, you know, in our country, like a true safety net for folks in this country, and how to implement one. And this kind of goes back to the public health issue that Bronski wrote about. Why even do we have homelessness? I mean, I've studied homelessness in the Netherlands, which is really interesting, and they have a whole different perspective. I mean, I've seen in Norway and Finland, these, you know, Scandinavian European countries, but they handle it much different. And their reasons for people being homeless is also much different. But they're bringing new and innovative ideas into it. And I think the U.S. is stuck in a bit of a rut of thinking about these, like, handful of solutions and not thinking further than that. So, again, this article is
right.
in the current issue of The New Yorker. It's also online. A Window Onto an American Nightmare by Nathan Heller. And I recommend reading them. I just told you some of what it is. This one in particular, like I said, is New Yorker style, super long, but I think worth it.
No, I thought it was extremely interesting. As you said, it gave a lot of different ways that people are approaching it, some different solutions. Some are amazing. Some, like I said, are better in certain situations and not for others. I really liked a lot of the ideas. I didn't like the one that kept giving them multiple chances over and over again. If they were kicked out of one housing, they got to go to another one. Wasn't happy
mm-hmm.
about that one, especially. But I think overall, there was a great review of the different policies. And also, as you said, talking about these people that they talk to, how the relapses occur and why they occur, and it gave a little bit of a glimpse
mm-hmm.
into that you don't often see.
Right, and I think, you know, it's the part of homelessness that people who aren't homeless generally don't understand, that it's super complicated. It's not just being pushed out of a home because of lack of affordability. It's not just because of mental illness. It's not just because of substance use. It's a multitude of things, for most people. You know, it's not just one. It's a panoply of enormous proportion.
Right.
So, yeah,
definitely.
I just want to tell people what I'm talking about, what I'm reading. I mean, I think that both articles are instructive in their own ways and kind of get to the heart of certain things that I think a lot of people think about. You know, folks listening, you know, I think we're conscientious people and think about these kind of things and what can we do. And these articles are not action points. It could, you know, put people to action or at least thinking about, like, this isn't what I always read about this, you know, in a newspaper story where it's like, oh, these crazy homeless people running around screaming. You know, that's a very superficial coverage of that kind of issue.
Well, I appreciate you bringing this to attention. I think we had a lot of great response from your first appearance 2 weeks ago. I'm looking forward to every other week here. It's going to be a good time. I mean, it's great to that's one of the reasons I did this, for to have people that are in the field that are quote unquote professional, or at least work with professionals and are able to give a good perspective. So thank you for doing this. I appreciate it.
And I'll have something different next time.
There you go. And let everyone know where they can find you on social media and talk about that great book of yours as well.
Yeah, so I'm the editor, co-editor, and I also have a piece of Headcase, LGBTQ Artists and Writers on Mental Health and Wellness. And I think it's actually Writers and Artists. It's an anthology with a number of pieces. I think there are 28 pieces of the whole spectrum of LGBTQ folks. And it cuts across racial, ethnic, socioeconomic, age, other gender identification, and other lines. So it's giving voice to people who don't usually have a voice. And it's really interesting, I think. And I think it should be read widely. And you can find me at Stephanie Schroeder Author, AUTHOR.com. And also on social media, Twitter and Instagram, at StephS910. Follow me.
There you go. Stephanie, thanks so much for being our special correspondent in mental health. We will see you in 2 weeks. Guys, we're going to play out a little song. We'll be back in just a little bit. You're listening to the Left of Straight Show right here on the Left of Straight Radio Network.
Hey, how you doing? Well, I guess I'm doing okay. An easy answer, but what else am I going to say when the times are tough? I put my guard up with a smile on my face. I'm learning to cry again. Open my eyes and diamonds roll down. Oh, why would I hold it in? Lump in my throat, a jewel for my gold crown. If you let your tears run free, you can be royalty. I'm learning to cry again, cry. Cry again, cry. I'm cutting onions, I'm doing everything that I can to show the world that I can be a sensitive man, to be vulnerable, to be so beautiful, and I'm tired of hiding. I'm learning to cry.
Hey.
am I gonna say when the times are tough? I put my guard up with a smile on my face. I'm learning to cry again. Open my eyes.
Alexander with Cry Again out of New York. If you missed Monday's show, we featured him on Monday's Musical Monday episode. Fantastic up-and-coming singer-songwriter that I just fallen in love with. Speaking of fall in love, I'm so excited to have my next guest on the show. It's been a while. He's been busy both in front and behind the camera with his duties as an actor and or producer in projects running from The Wild Ride in Youthful Days to guesting on the hugely popular Teen Wolf series, to the thought-provoking series of Connections and Six Degrees of Separation, to portraying the same character in two series, The Bay and YA. And I really loved his relevant documentary, Lost in America. Guys, he's been working, y'all. Let's take a second and catch up with the handsome and talented Mr. Mike Manning. Mike, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me back.
I appreciate you taking the time to come back. It's been a while since we talked. I've been really enjoying catching up with a lot of my old guests here. Of course, I follow you on social media, and you got that million-dollar smile and always such a positive attitude. How are you holding up during this whole COVID quarantine? You doing okay?
Yeah. I'm trying to make the most of it, and I feel like everybody that says that they're completely fine is lying. I feel like this is something that our country has never faced before in this larger scale. It's a worldwide pandemic. Every country is facing it in different ways, and it's completely changing our way of life before our eyes. And I think that I think that, you know, there are people that can go about their daily lives doing as much as they can from home. But for a lot of us, you know, it's changing the way we do business. It's changing with, you know, with phone calls and with Zoom and with things like that. One thing it has done for me is it has given me the time. I think that there's, you know, living in Los Angeles, there's always those friends that you meet and you're like, oh, hey, we should definitely do something together. Or, you know, there's always those hobbies that you think to yourself, oh, man, I would really love to do that if only I had the time. And that's
right.
What I've sort of been trying to focus on. So I'm actually writing a lot more. I'm writing a couple scripts with some friends of mine. I'm playing the guitar more. I'm going out and hiking in nature and spending time outside, just doing like secluded nature hikes and trails and things. So, you know, I'm really trying to stay positive and stay healthy mentally and take time for, you know, myself and also time to do the creative things that I've been putting off for so long. And also my dogs, they love it. My dogs, I've never spent more time with them. So
they're going to have separation anxiety when this is over, right?
yeah, with this quarantine thing, they love it. So, but
nice.
But yeah, good days and bad days. Good days and bad days.
There you go. We all are. I mean, there's no right or wrong way to do a pandemic. It's all new to all of us. So I understand
mm-hmm.
that completely. Let's talk a little bit. I mean, we've talked, I had your background on the last show. I mean, it went from your Colorado upbringing to real world, to politics, your entertainment career. You give so much of yourself to all of it. What are you really excited to get back to as this starts to slowly wind down here?
Well, I love, so there was this project, I've been working on this documentary, and you mentioned it in the intro, Lost in America, for 5 years now, and it's a documentary about homeless youth. And it started out as this tiny little passion project that a few of us got together to do. And in my mind, I was going to spend a couple months on it, maybe a year. And 5 years later, we finally finished the film. But what it became was amazing. It started out as this tiny little thing. And then little by little, it grew and it grew and it grew. And we got other people involved. And now a film with, you know, Rosario Dawson and Jewel are in the film, and they're also executive producers. We have Halle Berry, we have Jon Bon Jovi, we have Tiffany Haddish, we have Rebecca Gayhart Dane. So it's like we have Sanaa Lathan. So we have a lot of really talented, really well-known people in our film and supporting the film. And it's not just, oh, hey, insert celebrity here. It's like we got people that really talk about either their experiences living on the streets or in their cars or in, you know, battered women shelters or doing charitable work specifically for these organizations and having a knowledge base around helping these youth. So it's really become a wonderful film. And we were releasing in theaters in February, and then obviously COVID-19 happened and everything closed down, the theaters being the first among the first things to close down. So unfortunately,
right.
our theatrical release was sort of cut short, but we are releasing digitally June 9th, so next month, and that's something that's really exciting because we're hoping that, you know, while everybody's home or, you know, having this extra time, that they'll watch the film and support the film and learn a little bit more about what homeless youth are going through in our country today and how to help those youth.
Congratulations on that. I can't wait to see that. I mean, the LGBTQ youth is such a huge population in that homeless minority there, and it's great that we are focusing on it. It's something that I'm going to talk about it later, too, because I think there's so much we can do when this is over. Hopefully everyone is learning a little more patience, learning to love each other a little bit more, and we really have a starting over point if we decide to take it. So I think a film like can really do a lot of good putting it out in the world, especially with these big names attached. So good on you for doing that, man. That's fantastic.
Yeah, no, thank you. You hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what we hope to do with this film, is just to show people what these youth are going through. I became involved with this film because back, I guess this was like maybe 2011, 2012, around when I first had moved to Los Angeles, And I was volunteering for, I was doing some volunteer work, and I, because of everything that I did on the real world, there was this organization called LifeWorks, which was sort of a sister organization to the Los Angeles LGBT Center. And they had a program where they actually took youth off the streets. It's a transitional living program. They take youth off the streets and they teach them job skills. They help them with their diploma or their GED. They give them a place to live and, you know, food to eat and everything. And they actually help reintegrate them into society or really provide that safety net for youth that would otherwise be lost on the streets and have nowhere to go. So I fell in love with they gave me this award because of some of the political stuff I did on Real World. And I didn't really know much about the organization at the time. And then I took a tour of the LGBT center. And I remember walking around the center and walking around this where they had this program. And they had a bunch of different rooms, and each room had bunk beds. And this is where the kids obviously would live. And I remember looking around, and I saw the bunk beds, and I saw posters on the walls and trophies on the dressers and pictures, you know, on the walls. And it looked to me like a normal teenager's room. And I was going from room to room. I was learning more about the program. And I remember looking on one of the beds, and there was this yellow stuffed monkey. And just like this little simple yellow stuffed monkey, but it was one of the same stuffed monkey that I had on my bed when I was a kid. It was a yellow, yellow stuffed monkey.
Wow.
I won it at a carnival or something. And I just remember in that moment breaking down. And I like, you know, there were tears in my eyes, and I'm trying to hold it together in front of the volunteer that was taking me around the place. And I just remember thinking in that moment, like, wow, this could be me. These kids are here by no fault of their own. They have done nothing to deserve not having a place to sleep at night. And their survival is dependent upon the kindness of strangers. I have to do something. So that it was that moment that homeless youth, particularly LGBT youth and you know, homeless youth, became my sort of mission, my cause. And then so I started volunteering there. I threw a couple fundraisers for them. And then a couple years later is when that documentary found me. And it was just sort of a happy marriage of getting to create something that would help spread the message of a cause that became so important to me.
Well said. That is so terrific to hear. And, I mean, that's one of the things I love about you, man. You have a great heart. You find these passion projects where they find you. I mean, I remember you've worked with a project that's close to my heart, which is the Thirst Project. I just got a text yesterday. They're on their 11th year. They're giving everyone, I think, like 10,000 3-month trials to the Endel app that I downloaded yesterday and kind of fell in love with it. It's sort of like one of those calm apps. But you really put your heart into so many different things. Are they finding you? Do you find them? I mean, I'm sure they would love to have your voice, but what really sparks a passion in you when these things come to you?
Yeah, I think it's just, I think at least so far in my life, it's been these organizations finding me, and it's sort of the stars aligning and something that feels right in my heart to get involved with. With the Thirst Project, I met Pauly Perrette, who played Abby on NCIS for like 12 or 13 years. I met her in church, and we became friends, and she invited me to a gala for the Thirst Project. And this was, I believe, 9 years ago. So it was maybe their second year. And it was this, I went there and I learned about the Thirst Project and I fell in love with it. I fell in love with their mission. I fell in love with what they're trying to do for communities around the world, providing them safe, clean drinking water. And I became really good friends. He's one of my best friends now. With the founder, Seth Maxwell. And throughout the course of our friendship, I just learned more about the global water crisis and what Thirst Project was doing and became more and more involved. And now I'm on the board, and I actually am very hands-on in I'm giving my opinion about what the organization is doing, how they're spending their money and their resources, and really getting a behind-the-scenes look on all of the amazing things that they're doing that they don't even advertise. They're doing so many good things in people's lives just for the sake of doing them, not for a press article or anything like that. So it's really become an organization that I care a lot about.
Well, as I said, thank you for your heart, man. Let's go ahead and start circling back to your creative side and to your entertainment side. I love, I remember somewhere talking about saying you try to incorporate creative activism into your projects, and I think you just gave a great example about that. Talk about how this creative activism manifests itself in what you're looking to as a producer, because you were just creating some fantastic works out there, just in so many ways that, speaking of not people knowing about, you're behind the scenes in a lot of great things, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I just, for me, it's two sides of the coin. It's on one side, I'm an actor and I train and I try to stay creative and I try to stay available so that if there are film or television projects that I would be a good fit for, you know, I can meet with the director or the writer or whatever and possibly be a part of those. And that's sort of half my life, half my time. And then the other half of my time is writing and creating my own material. And I just sort of made the decision, like, if I'm going to produce and put my energy into things that I can choose and create myself, then why not make those things have a social message and make those things be projects that I'm proud of. And all the topics are, you know, they vary based on sort of what I care about at that point, you know, at that year.
right.
But I just, yeah, but these projects, I think, honestly, like I heard the saying, like when you're on the right path, everything just makes sense. And, you know, everything just comes to you. And that's really how it's been for me. I'll meet great people. I'll share something that we're all passionate about. And then we find a script and we make this movie. And the movies do really well because everybody involved is super passionate. I did this movie. I produced this movie that my friend Liam McKendrick wrote. It was called MFA, which stands for Master of Fine Arts. And it was a movie about a female art student that gets sexually assaulted on campus, and she turns around and goes on this vigilante mission to kill a bunch of rapists. And so it's a thriller. it's fun. It has, you know, the sexiness, the violence, the all that other stuff that make for an entertaining movie, and you get that escapism. But at the end of the day, the movie comments very heavily on rape culture, sexual assault, that sort of thing. So it was something that, like, I had a lot of fun doing. Because I was you know, a producer on that, but then at the same time, I was really proud to put it out into the world. And for a lot of the conversations, we had a female writer, a female director, and a female star sitting back and just watching this team really kick ass and make something great. And to be able to support them doing that was just really really something I enjoyed.
That's awesome. I love that. Well, speaking of combining your two worlds here, let's talk about The Bay and the spinoff YA. I mean, you've been both producer and actor on that. Congratulations on all the Daytime Emmy nominations that came out the other day. Talk about that project. What drew you to it, and what makes you so proud of that?
Yeah, well, if we're being honest, the show has been a success without me involved. It's in its fifth season. The fifth season just aired. And they have, I think, something like 18 Emmy wins over the last four seasons and, like, something like 36 nominations. Now it's, you know, now the nominations are in the 40s just with the new announcements that came out. So initially I found out about the show and they asked me to be involved. And I said, oh, like, of course I want to be involved with an Emmy winning show. Yeah, sure. Let's get that Emmy. And yeah, let's do it. So I became friends with the creator and the writer and the creator, and we came up with this really great character for me, and it was a character that I've never been able to play before, and so I said creatively, I was like, oh yeah, of course I would love to do this. And so the character is really interesting, and I'm not sure if I'll ever have this experience again in my life. So it was a really cool experience. On The Bay, I play a new love interest for one of the characters that is a series regular, that has been a series regular for the past four seasons. And so I'm a new love interest. So I am introduced to the story as this new, his name's Eric Nelson. I'm his new friend that comes into town. And there are several episodes where you realize that we used to be best friends when we were younger, but it's been a couple of years since we've seen each other, and a lot has changed. He's done some experimenting, and so have I. And so we sort of meet each other, and the audience isn't really sure, or neither are we. We're not really sure if we're best friends or if there's something more there. And then what's cool about it is on the YA, which is the spinoff, which a lot of characters from the Bay are going to be seen in YA. YA hasn't aired yet. They're still in post-production. I get to play that same character. I get to play, his name's Caleb McKinnon, but in the YA, I am a teacher. So you see the exact same character with a lot of similar characters that are in the same series, but it's in a whole different environment. He's in a school, he's a professional, he's trying to teach these younger students about all of these other things. And so you see, we shot him at the same time. So I was playing the exact same character on two shows that were basically different versions of the same world, but I was playing the two polar opposite sides of that same character, and we were shooting at the same time. So it was such a cool experience. I don't know if it'll ever happen for me again, but it was that was really, really, really awesome. And the fact that we had seven Daytime Emmy nominations for The Bay was incredible. The cast and the crew and everybody involved have just been so welcoming to me and just so loving, and I feel like part of their family now. So it's really cool to see everybody celebrate and, you know, be part of that.
That is so great. And it hasn't, like you said, it's been around for a while. It's an amazing cast. It has the soap opera aspect to it with some of the biggest stars from soaps on it. It's got the adventure and the excitement and the mystery and the intrigue. So it has it all. So congratulations on that. That's got to be a lot of fun. I can only imagine, my friend. And I saw I don't know if you guys are destined to work together forever, but Cody St. New, who's been on Teen Wolf and been on The Bay and been on other projects you've worked on, did you guys ever work together on Teen Wolf? He's been an amazing ally to our community. He seems like a very cool guy to work with.
Yeah, Cody is awesome. He's such a sweetheart. We've been friends for a long time. I'll tell you something that I haven't told anybody else in any interview ever. So Cody, when I first moved to LA, and I think he and I agreed to never talk about this, so I'm just messing it all up right now, but whatever. So when I first moved to LA, I was a red carpet host on the AMAs, the American Music Awards. And through that, I met this guy named David, and David had this idea to put together a boy band. And I had done some singing in high school, and I had done musicals and things, and I was involved in music. So he met me when we were hosting American Music Awards together and invited me to this meeting. And I had no idea what to expect. I show up to this meeting like it's going to be a sit-down thing. The meeting's at a dance studio, and he wants us – there's a group of guys there, and he wants us to practice some choreography – and talk about starting a boy band. And I had no idea, and I don't think Cody did either, but Cody was one of the guys that was there. And so we show up, we have no idea what we're getting into. We end up doing this like choreographed dance for 2 hours and just trying to be good.
Where is the
lost
footage on this when I need it? Oh my goodness.
I don't think there's any footage, and I would never tell you if there were. But it was, and so that was my first kind of time meeting Cody. And then over the years, we became buddies, and then he was on Teen Wolf, and we actually didn't work together on Teen Wolf. I was in the last season, and he wasn't on the show anymore by then. So we didn't work together on Teen Wolf, but we were friends during that. And, we shot 6 Degrees of Separation together. And that was where we really became close. It was a small cast, and it was a project where we had to be, every character was so vulnerable in their own way that the actors really had to trust each other and become close to make the set feel like a safe to really go there. And so I spent a lot of time with Cody during that experience, and that's when we became better friends.
That is awesome. And a behind the scenes scoop. Oh my gosh, we're going to burn that footage if you ever find it. I can tell already. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I promise not to keep you too long because we are actually taping this on Memorial Day weekend. So I appreciate you taking the time. I want to get real quickly back to the writing. You say you're writing some scripts. I mean, you have had an interesting life, my friend. We're talking real world. We're talking, you worked for Governor Polis now. He wasn't governor at the time. You have this amazing entertainment career. Have you ever thought about writing a little bit of your life story? You're so freaking humble. I can't imagine you doing that, but I think it would be an amazing book.
Well, thank you. I don't know if I'll ever do that. You know, maybe when I'm 100 and tired and have nothing else to do, then maybe maybe I'll do that. But by then, nobody will be reading books. We'll be absorbing info and these microchips in our brains. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. I actually, the first script I ever wrote was based on a young press secretary that was challenging his congressman when he found out that his congressman was corrupt. So the script, when I moved to Los Angeles, the script that sort of got my foot into the door with TV development was actually a script that was based on politics. So I did actually try to take some of my own experience and write it into a script. And that's how I met my producing partner. We started working together on all these things. So I actually have, I did take, because they always say write from what you know. I have done that. And the script, it's changed over the years. The lead is now this female press secretary, and it has a lot of great elements to it, and I might bring it out one day. I might try to produce that and make that happen, but for now I'm just focusing on other things.
Well, Mike Manning, it's been an absolute pleasure being able to catch up with you. Thanks so much for taking your time. For those that have been living under rocks, I don't know where they can find you on your social media, your website, things like that.
Yeah, everything's just really easy. I keep it simple. It's my handle on all social media is just at Mike C. Manning. And then the website is just Mike Manning, MikeCManning.net.
For Mike, always a pleasure. Best of luck on all your projects. You have so many fingers and so many pies, and they all turn out to be some amazing pieces of work. I appreciate you, my friend. Thanks for being on the show.
Scott, no, thanks for having me, man. Thanks for saying that. And I appreciate you caring about the little things I'm doing. So enjoy your Memorial Day weekend too, and thanks everybody else for listening.
You as well. Stay on the line, my friend. We're going to play out to a little bit of music. I'll be back in a little bit. You're listening to Left of Straight Show right here on the Left of Straight Radio Network.
You're right.
Alrighty, guys and gals, we are back. That was our good friend Kenneth Mogan with You and Me. The release just came out last week. Be sure to check that out on your favorite iTunes or Spotify distributors. Guys, I'm so happy to have my next guest on. It's her very first time on the Left of Straight show. It's been a hot minute since I've even talked about foodies on the show, and I'm very excited to get back to it. She has an amazing Instagram blog where she posts some delicious-looking food from across the country. She lives in New York City, which is, of course, one of the best foodie destinations in the country. And let's talk to her all about it. Please welcome to the show for the very first time, Ramis. Ramis, how you doing?
Hey, how are you, Scott? I'm doing well.
I am so happy to have you on. We were connected by our good friend Jake Taylor, and I'm just excited to talk to you.
Yeah, this is going to be great. I mean, he told me about what you do, and, you know, anytime a conversation about food is prompted, I'm very excited about it. So this was an easy, like, let's get this going. Easy.
There you go. Well, I do want to see how you're holding up. You are in New York, and how are you doing in COVID? Are you in a quote-unquote essential worker and having to go out in it, or are you just kind of having to deal with everything that's going on?
I mean, it's been a little bit weird, you know, the first few weeks, but things are getting a little bit better. I am not technically an essential worker, but thankfully I still have my job. I'm working from home. My partner is an essential worker. She actually works in Brooklyn. And, you know, it's been a weird balance, but, you know, we're doing the best we can. We're trying to follow all the rules, and we're doing the thing that we need to do.
There you go. Well, stay safe and healthy, and thank your partner for being on the front line there. We definitely appreciate that.
Every night, you know, it's at 7 p.m. in New York. I don't know if you've heard, but we have a tradition here since everything started where at 7 p.m. you clap for all the essential workers. And it's been very nice. It's been super, you know, coming together. You feel very whole as a city in a way. And, you know, my girlfriend will be home by 7 p.m. So sometimes I may not want to open the window. So I'll just kind of go in the bedroom and just start clapping in front of her face. And it's sweet.
Nice.
It's good. And it's a nice thing that's been happening out here for sure.
I love it. Well, I do love that. I mean, it's been really cool. It's going on. I do hope this is going to cause a small shift in our society. We see a lot of people in the states that are reopening going back to really stupid behavior. But I love the clapping and things. If we just did that once a month for different essential people, I would love to see the camaraderie and the actual caring for our fellow man blossom out. We'll see how long it lasts, though, right?
Yeah, I know. I mean, and it's like I said, you feel together as a community. But, like, you know, I think this is one of those things where people have to really, like, take a look and think about, you know, who's been working the last couple of weeks and putting themselves, you know, like, out there and at risk in a way. And, you know, these are the people who you really need to start paying a little bit more attention to.
Exactly. Well said.
Yeah.
Well, let's start with a little bit of background. Since it's your first time on the show, where did you actually grow up? What kind of a kid were you? And what did you first want to be when you grew up?
I love all these questions. So the first one, I'm actually from New York. I'm born and raised in New York. I've lived here my entire life, but I've lived in various parts of New York. So originally I'm from Mount Vernon. I grew up in Middletown, New York. I lived in Harrison, New York for a little bit, and then I've moved into the city. I've been here for about 10 years. As a kid, I was very athletic. I did every sport you could think of. I was always into trying a bunch of different things, and, you know, eventually that blossomed out to food. I did have one primary focus for a very long time, so I didn't get a chance to really experiment when it came to, you know, eating too many different things and traveling all over the place for, you know, cuisines and making my own things. So I was just very busy. But after I started to discover, you know, finding my own time and making my own schedule and stuff like that, I finally was able to, you know, get into trying all the different things. So as a kid, I was a little bit different and focused on, you know, a bunch of other things. Now I can kind of chill and take my time with it.
Nice. I love that. All right. So let's talk a little bit about, I'm not as much interested in people's coming out stories. Those are usually very personal then, but talk about, when did you first come out to yourself, and when did you first kind of find your tribe and feel like you were part of the community?
Wow. That's actually a great question, because, like, you know, for me, thankfully my coming out process wasn't as, I guess you could say, it wasn't as scary as some stories I've heard, you know, and for other people, it was hard, but it was also something that they felt like they can manage and, you know, still kind of make their own. And luckily I had a similar situation. When I was maybe around, you know, when I was a teenager, which a lot of us, I get, you know, I feel like we all can relate on those things. And you look at, you know, people of the same sex and people of the opposite sex, and you start to wonder, like, you know, what is this feeling me? What is this about? And as I got a little bit older into my later teens, around like 19, I started to really come into my own as far as, you know, recognizing, okay, I might be bisexual. Like, I'm not sure what's happening here, but I'm going to run with this. Right? I'm going to run with the bisexual thing. Love on my bias. I'm just kidding. But no, like, you know, it was one of those things where, again, I wasn't sure. So I kind of went with that feeling. Maybe when I was about 22, 23, I was finding myself going, you know, to a lot more parties that were not just necessarily focused on lesbians or gay people, but, you know, just an LGBT plus family surrounding all the way around. So you had people who, you know, maybe went by as non-binary, or they identified as just queer and, you know, didn't really know where they felt as far as, you know, gender went, and, you know, people were gender fluid, and, it, you know, it exposed me to a lot of other things that I felt a lot more comfortable with. So I guess now I feel like, you know, coming out for me at the time was so much easier based on what I've heard, you know, up until this point. But after I started to get a little bit more involved in, you know, everything else, I eventually, you know, my friends knew, and, you know, some family members knew, and I didn't really have to come out and say it. They just kind of knew and, you know, waited for me to, like, I guess, throw in, like, oh, I met this really cool girl the other day. And they'd be like, oh, yeah, are you going to see her again? Like, they would, you know, they would, like, test the waters and see, like, what I responded to best. But I guess you could say the process in that way was pretty easy. I, you know, was able to make friends going out, and, you know, I went on online dates and all that stuff. And it was one of those things where I eventually started going out on my own, because, you know, I'd meet people, but, like, if they weren't free, and I'm just like, listen, I need to be around some ladies. I got to just go out. So I would go out by myself and make friends that way. I know, very bold. It's like crazy move, but, like, I just had a couple drinks and I was good to go.
Nice.
But yeah, that was like my early on process. And then I eventually told my mom in my mid-20s. She was the last person I told, only because, you know, as a Black woman as well, my family's from Jamaica. So there are certain traditions and morals that, you know, you kind of stand by. People who are very old school in that way, they're, you know, they're going to stick to these certain morals. And I guess that goes to a lot of other cultures, but speaking on this one specifically. And I also grew up in a Christian church. So it was a very touchy subject that I wasn't sure I wanted to bring up. I eventually told her. It was weird at first, but she, you know, let me know right away. It doesn't matter. I love you. I will learn to come around, and, you know, it'll be fine. Don't worry about it. Everything's okay. And it was really nice. And, you know, she eventually met my girlfriend, and everything's cool now. It's good. It's nice.
Very, very good. I like it. Well, let's start with what your actual definition of a foodie is. What do you consider a foodie? What does a foodie mean to you?
Oh, boy. Okay. So this is a tough one. So a foodie to me, I guess, would be someone who is, you know, the idea of having a meal together or experiencing, you know, a new cuisine or trying a new dish or checking out a new restaurant, bar, a certain space. I feel like if you get super excited about the idea, and it's just like, and it's, you know, if I ask you and your response is, yeah, that'll be cool, I'm like, okay, you want to go and chit chat. I want to go and talk about the food. Like, I don't want to, like, go and mouth gag. Like, this is about the meal, okay? And if your response is a little bit more like, oh, my God, yes, I heard about this place. It sounds so good. I went to their Instagram page. Let's do it. And I'm like, you're who I want to hang out with, you know? So, like, if you get excited about just a meal, or, like, you know, just show a slight interest in what we're about to have to eat, then I think that would make you a foodie.
And to me, a foodie is not necessarily a cook either. I think you just appreciate it, right? Because I didn't cook for a long time. I'm learning, still learning, but I don't think you necessarily have to know how to cook to be a foodie, right?
Right, no, for sure. I agree.
And talk about when you're going out to eat and you're having this communal experience, talk about the actual experience versus the food. What do you like, as you kind of hit on it there a bit, talk about that as far as what makes a good group of people to go out to eat with.
So for me so whenever I'm putting a group together and I'm like, okay, you know, I really want to check out this restaurant and I feel like we need to go with at least like 3 to 4, maybe 6 people or something like that, I try to reach out to people who are, like I mentioned before, you know, they're going to be excited. They're going to be really interested in possibly, you know, checking out a certain dish, or, you know, they heard about this style of food and they want to be able to, you know, experience doing the whole like dipping. So for example, I guess I could give you one. There's a place in Brooklyn called, excuse me, I don't want to get the location wrong. There's a place called Burrito Taco. They're actually a food truck. They do burrito style tacos, if I'm pronouncing the term correctly. But basically what it is it's like a meat, like stuffed taco with, it's a beef. I like haven't had it in such a long time. I'm like trying to remember all the ingredients. I'm sorry. But it's a braised beef, and it comes off the bone, and they make a broth and a soup with it, and you would put tacos into that soup. And, you know, you see the videos of it, and you're just like, first of all, I love tacos. Second of all, that looks really, like, juicy because they put the tortillas in the gravy a little bit, and they douse it. Yeah, it's great. but, you know, they marinate it a little bit. They cook everything together, and you do this whole thing where you dip it into the soup, and it just – I see that, and I'm like, I want to do that. So I knew that there was a food truck out here in the city that did it. I, you know, took the trip out there with my friend. He lives out in, like, far Brooklyn. I was like, dude, we got to go do this. He was like, what time? We met up at this food truck. We had these tacos. It was awesome.
Like a French dip taco. I like that. That sounds amazing.
Yes.
Very, very
cool. I'm going to find the name for you, but I'm going to think of it. But yes, it was such an awesome, like cool, fun thing. And I believe that it's a big trend in LA. So next time you're out there, definitely try to, you know, see if you can find your place.
I will look for it. Now, a food truck is in and of itself its own experience, right? I mean, do you enjoy finding a good food truck? Is that an exploration you take on?
I do like food trucks. The only thing is, like, it's been a little bit tougher for me to find them as far as, like, whenever there's any big food truck, like, events happening and stuff like that, because they're not as popular in New York. And when I find out about them, it's, like, the day of. And I know that, like, in other places, like, when I went to Portland, like, that place, oh, my God, the food truck, like, Mecca, it was incredible. There was, like, the options were endless. It was like, I mean, have you been to Portland, Oregon before? Because it's fantastic for food, by the way.
I lived there for 4 years, and it wasn't a food truck haven as it is now, but I know the area where they all meet at because they did what's called Saturday Market there all the time. And so it was a big bazaar type thing where they had lots of vendors, food people vendors and crafts and homemade things like that. But now it's a food truck Mecca, and I haven't been to that, so I would love that.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's fun. Like, we, you know, I've gone to like a few different taco places, and like, you, and for me, when I go to these spots, I look around and I like follow the smell, and like, I don't even see the name when people ask me, like, oh, did you try this? Did you try that? I'm like, probably, I don't know. It's just for me, I see it, and it like the aroma catches me, and I like look at it, and I'm like, I want that. I like eat with my eyes, and then game over. Then I like start doing my like research for it.
I hear ya. Yeah, my buddy Dom has been on the show a couple times. Dom, he owns the mac and cheese truck there, the food mac truck, or how's he call it, the mac truck, something like that, in New York City.
Yeah.
And I've never been to that yet. He's been on the show like 3 times. I haven't had a chance. And I kind of like a little mac and cheese comfort food. He serves it like 12 different ways. So very, very cool. I do love to find a good food truck. Now, you do it all. I love the three things that you look for: flavor, presentation, and the money shot, how it looks and appears. Talk about that, and talk about how that's combined with your love of travel and photography. Have those things always merged, or have you kind of started with one or the other and just been able to pull that together like a perfect dish?
I mean, sort of. So as a kid, what I was mentioning before, when I was saying I was really busy for a certain period of time, I played tennis for about 10 years competitively. So I spent a lot of time, so I spent a lot of time on the court, you know, doing a lot of practice, a lot of time in the gym. And when I wasn't doing those things, I was traveling for tournaments. So during those moments of, you know, being on a plane, you know, 3 or 4 times a month and, you know, just being on the move a lot, you know, road trips 5 times a year, 6 times a year. It was a lot of moving around. And I've been to Ohio a couple of times, actually. I've actually been to Columbus, Ohio. So it's, I've been to a few, so I've traveled down to a few different places. So that kind of got me comfortable with the travel sensation of, you know, like preparing for a trip and, you know, kind of saying, okay, this is my itinerary, you know, here's how, and, you know, this is at the time when MapQuest was cool and, navigation systems were happening. So, like, I had to make sure, okay, like, I had my travel planned. I knew what time I was leaving. This is where all the rest stops were. Okay, I'll stop and get gas here if I need. Like, I had that whole plan, and I love the idea of planning things out in that way. So when I finally took a break from tennis and I started to do my own thing, got a full-time job, and I had weekends off and all the things, I learned how to, like, start planning, like, my own trips. And a few of the trips ended up being planned around food. So whenever I would plan stuff now, I'm like, okay, before I do anything, let me make sure going to this place is actually going to be worth it, because I don't want to just go there if it's, you know, if it's like one site and I'm not going to eat well. Like, it's not, it doesn't work out. So that's how that kind of started. But it definitely tied into, like, when I was in high school, I got really into photography. So that kind of, like, slowly made its way through my life into this time where, like, I'm like, oh my God, I can finally, like, practice and, like, get better at my pictures. And I, like, look at my timeline every so often and I'm just like, oh, the glow up is real. You know, so, like, it's a fun experience where I get to, like, practice that fun hobby and, you know, be able to still travel and, you know, see a lot of different places, which is, like, fucking cool and awesome. And, you know, that definitely comes together nicely. I like that.
I love that. That's awesome. I just found the foodie app on my phone that takes pictures of food and makes it pretty. I've never heard of that before. Cause I do my food from time to time. I take pictures, but I don't always take pictures of it. And so somehow I came across this foodie app, and it takes beautiful pictures. It has all the filters. Do you use that at all?
So I definitely touch on my photos. I mean, you know, photos are dull sometimes. So I do definitely go ahead and make some adjustments and stuff like that. But I use a slew of apps only because, you know, depending on the outcome of the photo itself, I may say, okay, I might want to do this kind of, you know, touch to it. So I may open, like, the Photoshop app, or, like, I'll say, you know, maybe I want to add some cool effects to my videos, and then I'll open up the Fonto app. So these are all, like, a few different, you know, things that I like to use and mix up just based on the kind of content I got going on.
Nice. So that was my next question, because you do have this, you've turned it into a photographic blog on your Instagram. The shots are amazing. So I was wondering what it takes to create those and take the shot. How many shots do you usually take of a particular dish? And then how long does it take to edit? Is it, could it be short to long, or is it always long, or has it come down to science now?
I wish I could say it's come down to the science, but to be totally fair, I am a little bit of a perfectionist. So when I'm, you know, when I do take my photos, I don't know if it's because people haven't said it, because, like, you know, people can be embarrassed, but no one's ever said to me, like, can you please stop? So, like, I do get up on the chair and I do, like, okay, you know, move your arm, hold it like this, do that, position it this way, you know?
That's hilarious.
And my girlfriend, bless her heart, she literally takes, like, all my direction, all my, you know, like, okay, hold it this way. And she's like, wait, I got to move this. I don't want anyone to see my nail. It doesn't look good. And, like, it's like a whole thing. But I do.
That's
I probably
love
take,
right,
like,
there. True love is how they hold your plate for you.
I had this conversation with another friend because she makes her boyfriend do the same thing. And she's like, oh, my God, he has the best hand. And, like, we get into this whole – it's the whole thing, but yes, it's so important when your partner can, like, do the thing for you, with you. It's very nice. Yeah, like, between that, I probably take, like, 15 to 20 photos, and it depends, because, like, if I'm sitting and the lighting behind me looks really good, I don't need to take that many photos. I might need to just move the plate a couple times and, like, lift my hands a few times, and, like, that's it. Maybe it's, like, somewhere around 10. But if we're in a space where, you know, okay, it's a little darker and I got to, like, hold my girlfriend's phone light when one way and I got to put my phone the other way. And it's just like, so you got to try to find a better angle. So if it's, like, really dark, that's when I, like, struggle a little bit more. But if it's, you know, nice natural lighting, it might just be there waiting for me already.
There you go. Oh, that's awesome. I love that. I love the collaborative process with the girlfriend. That is fantastic. I love that.
Yeah, it's important.
Now talk about, are you a flavor person more than an ingredient person? Are you fine with just a real plain presentation with lots of flavor, or do you like seeing lots of things on an item, drag it to the kitchen and see what happens?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. Yeah, so it kind of depends because, you know, I do, well, first let me say I do love flavor over ingredient because it really doesn't matter what I'm eating. I mean, it matters what I'm eating, but like it doesn't matter too much what I'm eating versus how it tastes, because I want to be able to say, okay, guys, I had this really weird thing the other day, but it was really, really good and it was super unexpected. And people do eventually come up to me and, you know, say like, oh my God, I tried that thing that you talked about. It was so good. Or, you know, you should really go to this place because I know that you like this or you might really like that. So for me, it's a matter of like the experience of just trying something versus like being very particular on like what's in it.
Right.
But also, what was the other part of that question? I'm sorry. I know that was the first part.
No, that was pretty much it. Is like if there was a specific preference for, do you like a lot of build on it? Something. Some people like stuff with stuff. You need to have 8,000 toppings on a burger when you can have just a really good flavor to a burger with one or two things.
Well, now let's not forget we are still doing the photo. So I mean, the more crazy stuff on it, the better. You know, in a sense. So like, it definitely does make for a good photo if it does have a lot more things going on. But if it's a really good pasta from like a really great Italian place, usually those are not going to be wildly dressed up besides like, you know, really good sauce, really well-cooked pasta and maybe some cheese and like some peppers or something on top of it. But besides that,
right,
it can be very simple, but it could also taste out of this world. So it could have that, you know, one way or the other, or maybe I'll have, you know, some crazy nachos or something like that from, you know, for example, I go to Three Sheets Bar a lot, you know, can't wait to go back there. But Three Sheets in NYC, they have these nachos that have this, you know, this incredible dressings on it. And again, mind you, it is just basic cheese, jalapeno, you know, lettuce, beans maybe, and like, you know, some sour cream, stuff like that. But it looks great to the camera. So, and it tastes fine. So like, it's just one of those things where, you know, you're trying to find the balance between the two. But I mean, good food is great food, and good photos are beautiful photos. So that's
there you go. Well said. Now you're in New York, which is one of the food hubs, and it's not just a melting pot of people and ethnicities, a melting pot of different types of food. Are there certain neighborhoods that are just, how many neighborhoods of foods have you found in your travels? Because there's so many different types of people there. How do you break it down?
So being in New York City, the one area that I think like you're going to find a million food options, some really good food options, and you know it's kind of like endless, like there's so many, is definitely going to be the East Village, Lower East Side. Like you're going to have places like you know, Cat's Deli is going to be down there, and you're going to have like incredible, you know, like Otto Tacos down there, and you have like, you know, you have a lot of different places that, you know, you have a lot of like Asian cuisines as well, so the options are endless, and you're going to have a lot of different things to choose from. And I mean, incredible, like Mr. Taka Ramen, like there's a few different places that you're going to be able to say, okay, I could sit on like one corner and point out like 10 restaurants that I could like eat from. It's crazy. Another area that I think is definitely starting to like build its food, I guess for me personally, build its food like reputation, is definitely going to have to be, I think, Hell's Kitchen. Like it's not anything crazy as far as like food goes, but like I've been able to find a couple like little hidden spots there. Even on the Upper East Side, which is where I live now, I've been able to again find like, you know, a couple like really little hidden gems, and there aren't that many places where, in my personal opinion, that really sparked my interest too much. And I'm guilty of ordering from the same places on Grubhub when I am home, but when I do go to other places in the city and I'm like, you know, maybe I'm at a friend's house or something and I'll see something that looks a little bit interesting, or even just ask a recommendation, I'm ready to try something else that's out there. But there are a couple of places out here that are still kind of nice, but definitely the East Village is where you're gonna like hit the nail on the head. Lower East Side, like, it's crazy down there.
Nice. Yeah, I've heard that Hell's Kitchen has totally turned around. It's become so gay-centric now, I guess, and it's really turned, it used to be kind of a bad neighborhood. Now it's just very trendy and stuff. So, yeah, very cool.
Yeah, I've spent, like, too much time in Hell's Kitchen.
Now, one of the problems I had, because I can't get to New York as often as I used to, and even when I used to go fairly often, every other month or so, the thing that drives me crazy about New York, and I want to know if you come across this, is because of the competition, because of the prices of rents and everything, my favorite restaurants are usually gone within 1 year of 2 years from the time I've been there, sometimes 6 months. Have you come across that at all, a lot of restaurant turnover?
Yeah, and, you know, again, that's something that's been happening in my neighborhood in particular, and I think it's because, you know, since it's so residential and people are trying to, you know, discover that next neighborhood to really make, like, really cool and fun. You do happen to see that here in this particular neighborhood. But for me, I've been lucky enough to find places that I can go back to. There was one place, though, that had a sushi pizza. And this was when sushi pizza just came, like, you know, through, like, you know, Insider Food or something like that. I think that might have been where I heard about it. And it was, like, this popular craze that was starting to take wind. And I found a place that had sushi pizza, and it was really good. My girlfriend and I had it a couple times. And I think we, after our, like, third time, we, like, tried to find it online, and we couldn't find it. Come to find out they closed, and I was just like, are you kidding me? Like, this is fantastic. But luckily, I've been able to find a lot more places that I can go back to on a regular basis and, you know, harass the same people and look at the menu like it was the first time.
Nice. Now, are either you or your girlfriend are cooks? Do you guys cook much at home?
I love cooking. I've actually discovered that I enjoy cooking quite a bit in the last, like, 2 years or so. She doesn't cook too much, but I don't mind cooking for her because she is, like, very good at making me feel like I'm the best chef ever sometimes. So, like, I'll cook something and it can be very simple, and I'll look at her and I'm just like, how is it? And she's like, really good. And I'm like, yes.
Nice. So if you
go
on any of the food channel or cooking channels, cooking competitions, what would you like to try first?
MasterChef. That is, like, I feel like I would excel at MasterChef. Not that I'm, like, a MasterChef, but I feel like the competition and the style of, like, you know, the way that they do everything, I feel like I could, like, you know, bang out a couple, like, Google searches and be like, how do I make this thing? Got it. And, like, get right to it. Like, I love the energy that they have, really.
I like it. Very, very cool. I want to finish up here with, usually I do a 5 questions with my guests off air, but I'm going to do this on air with you, and then I'll add it to the everything. I'm going to twist yours up a little bit. My 5 questions are 5 usually different questions, but as we've been talking, I've been kind of thinking, and I think we're going to include it in this. I have a bunch of questions that I had where I'm looking for some top 5 things I would like your advice on, okay?
Okay.
All right. So for you, give me your top 5 ingredients or flavor profiles.
Oh, my God. Okay. Top 5 ingredients or flavor profile. So it has to be a little salty. Like, I love me some bacon, so if it has bacon on there, that's probably a really good thing. I do love some jalapenos. A little spicy would be good. Oh, my God. I love some avocado, so that nice creamy texture is, like, oh, fantastic. Mm. I do like some crunch. I do love some crunch. So if I'm going to, like, to be honest, and this is, like, really bad, but I eat chips with almost every meal. Like, maybe not breakfast, but, like, when it comes to, like, lunch and probably dinner, I may have the bag of chips open at some point. so there's that crunchy and salty together. And what's another one? I guess I do love a little, like, a little sugar. That's so basic. I don't know. I mean, I guess a little sugar is good. Like, I just realized I could freaking season the hell out of some steak the other day. Like, I made some skirt steaks, and, like, I found the seasoning that had a little sugar in it, and I was like, I never thought about sugar. Oh, my God. And I threw that on there, and my girlfriend was like, this is really good seasoning. And I was just like, yep, did it again.
There you go. I like it. Those are 5 great choices. I'm the same way as far as crunchy. I have to have texture in my food. If it's too mushy, I don't like it. Even I kind of just moaned a bit at your guacamole, but even guacamole, I have to have, like, really diced tomatoes, thick, a nice chunky tomato or something like that. I need to have some kind of a texture in my food. So
yeah,
I love that.
Even so. Yeah.
And speaking of spices, what are 5 spices that you need to have in your kitchen at all times?
Oh, my God. 5 spices I need to have in my kitchen. Okay. All right. So you got to have garlic powder. That is always, like, a nice, safe route to go when you're just trying to add a little bit of flavor to something, but you're not entirely sure how it's going to go. You definitely want to have some sea salt or some kosher salt, something that's a little coarse would be really nice. You definitely want to have some cayenne pepper. If you don't have cayenne pepper in your kitchen, I'm not entirely sure what you're trying to make that tastes good, but you got to have a little cayenne pepper in there. Definitely some black pepper, because that's always, again, safe with that, you know, sea salt taste. It's a little bit of a coarse look, but make sure that it's with the peppercorn. So again, you want to have a little bit of some visual in there, but again, some texture. And I think the last thing you definitely want to have is maybe some onion powder to onion powder to complement the garlic powder. You know, so again, if you're trying to add a little bit of flavor, but you're not sure where you're gonna go, those two definitely come together nicely.
Good choices all. I like that. And let's go the opposite now, as far as top five ingredients or flavor profiles. What's the worst five ingredients or flavor profiles you like to have in a meal?
Oh, God. Five worst? I'm not so crazy about coconut. Like, I like coconut water, and I can drink that, you know, whatever, almost on a daily basis. But, like, I cannot have coconut in my food. That's, like, a no-no. Oh, my God. I definitely hate pickles. Super unpopular opinion, but I really don't like pickles. I've had like three or four picklebacks in my life, and you know, I have it and I'm like, oh, that wasn't so bad. But then I think about it the next day and I'm like, oh, what were you thinking? So pickles are like, I guess the same goes for cucumber. Anytime I'm eating a salad and there's cucumbers in it, I take it out and my girlfriend's like, can I have those? I'm like, you can do whatever you want with them. So cucumbers, what else? There isn't too much. I mean, I've gotten a little bit better as a grown-up. As a child, it was definitely like, you know, get the shit out of here, but I've gotten a little bit better. I guess I'm not super wild and crazy. Like, I'll have it sometimes, and again, another really unpopular opinion, but chocolate, especially dark chocolate, like, I'll eat milk chocolate and white chocolate, like, once a month maybe, but, like, dark chocolate, get that shit out of here. None of that. Excuse me. Never, ever. And I think that's four, right? Not five.
That's four.
All right. I think I got one more. Pretty sure there's something else I don't like. There has to be something else I don't like, right?
Okay.
So, like, anything that's super gooey, like, gloppy, like, I like jelly, and, like, but I won't eat honey, like, by itself. Like, I love honey and, like, my tea and everything like that, but I will not, like, I think stuff that like goes down that way is like not, that's not good for you. That can't be good for you.
There you go. All right. Very good. That's good. Five. One. All right. What are your five favorite food cities? Five favorite food cities.
Oh my God. This is like, this has to be my favorite question. Okay. Five food cities. Number one is probably going to be New Orleans. I went to New Orleans a couple of years ago, and I think I had something new every day. And I think we were there for 5 days, but I had like two or three different new, like, different things every day. It was top notch. Next favorite food city was definitely Portland. Check it out. Portland, Oregon. If you've never been, or like, well, you've been, but for anybody who's listening, if you have not been, definitely take like a good 3-4 days. You know, fly out there, chill in an Airbnb, and like just have all the food. But definitely map it out before you go and be ready to have suggestions on, or like take suggestions, you know, like on the spot. Another city that was really good for food, Austin, Texas. I went there maybe like a year and a half ago. And, you know, for Austin, I don't think they've been too much on the map when it comes to, you know, having a foodie culture. Well, you know, until like pretty recently, I want to say in the last like 2 years. But it has definitely, they definitely have shown up, and it is a very cool city to check out when you are, you know, ready to have some fun food. Another city is definitely here in New York. There's a shit ton of options, but it's also, you know, like anything that comes out as far as, you know, trends go, or anything that is, you know, like really fun and popular, you know, like attractions, whatever the case is, festivals, it's all happening here in New York. So if you ever want to check out, just like, if you want to have like endless options of food, definitely come to New York. And I think my fifth favorite foodie city is probably, I like Miami. I had a good time in Miami with their food. Like, you know, when you go down to South Beach, you go down to South Beach, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of culture happening down there. So you get a lot of, you know, Latin food, a lot of Hispanic food, and it's fun and it's nice. And I, you know, being somebody from Jamaica, or well, not directly from Jamaica, but being Jamaican, I do get exposed to a lot of foods and those flavors already. So being able to go down there and try things that are, again, very familiar, it's really cool and nice, for sure. So I think those top five right there.
Great choices. And last top five give me the 5 most recommended kitchen gadgets to have in your kitchen.
Ooh, 5 most recommended. Okay, so this is going to be off of personal experience. I wish I had a mixer. A mixer is, like, super nice to have when you're, like, really getting that arm work going. So a mixer would be cool. I also have a Magic Bullet. Magic Bullet is freaking awesome. It definitely does the job. Like, I mean, obviously, if you're making smoothies, you can't have anything that isn't blender style. But it is nice when I'm making things like chicken salad, and I don't want to sit there and chop up the chicken. I throw it in there and cuts it up pretty nice for me in a minute or two. Nice. Another great kitchen gadget is a slow cooker. Oh my God. If you don't have a slow cooker, you're only limiting to yourself to only so many things that you can make. Like, a slow cooker opens up the game so much. So if you can get one of those, that'd be really great. My toaster oven. Thank God for my toaster oven. it is such an upgrade from a microwave and, you know, like, obviously a regular toaster. So, like, a toaster oven is a nice, cool addition to have for sure. And the mecca, the queen of it all, my dishwasher. Like, without this thing, I would be so much more miserable than I am right now.
I like it. Those are awesome. Those are 5 fantastic 5 questions kitchen edition. That's my very first kitchen edition for 5 questions. I like it a lot. I'm going to have to get some more foodies on to do that. Very nice. Well, Ramiz, it's been amazing getting to talk to you. Let everyone know where they can find your Instagram and follow all these gorgeous travels you've had and these pictures that you take.
All right. So you can definitely find me on Instagram at FeedRamiz. That is FeedRamize. And there's where I post all my photos, everything that comes to travel, to food, and anything in between. But definitely check me out there, and I'm going to have some new projects coming soon, hopefully once quarantine is over. But that is where everything is happening.
Fantastic. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the Left to Straight show. We have to have you back very
soon.
I could talk food all day, every day. So thanks for your time.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. That was awesome.
All right, well, stay on the line for me. Guys, we're going to play a little music. I'll be here on the other side. Thanks again, Ramiz. You're listening to the Left of Straight show right here on the Left of Straight Radio Network.
Knowledge, touch,
righty, guys, we are back. That was Kim Cameron with Simply Naked. Guys, I hope you enjoyed the show tonight. A big thanks to all my guests, Stephanie Schroeder for a fantastic Mental Health Minute, Mike Manning, he was hopefully going to try to come down to the Palm Springs big gay road trip and meet us in Palm Springs. I always like to catch up with what he's doing. He has so much projects going on at once. He's just a great producer now. And Ramis Ellis, guys, I fell in love with Ramis on our interview this last week, so I have made her our official new special correspondent foodie. She's going to be coming on every other Thursday here. Stephanie will be on with a Mental Health Minute 1 week, and then Ramis will be on with a Foodie Minute the next week, every other Thursday. So look for next Thursday, June 4th, will be Ramis's first little Foodie Minute right here on the Leftist Trade Show. I'm excited to have her as part of the team. Hope you guys enjoyed all of the show. Again, go ahead and follow me on Instagram and on Twitter. It's at Left of Straight. That's always spelled LeftOfStr and the number 8. On Facebook, the Left of Straight Show is our page. And my personal file, you can send me a friend request over there. The website, www.leftofstraight.com, spelled the same way, is going to have all the big gay road trip information up this weekend. We're trying to get it up this week and just did not get the time to get it done. So be sure to look for that. Tomorrow, we're going to finish up our day 5 of fantastic shows this week and interviews. And I have some great guests tomorrow. We're going to start it off with a Friday Fitness Minute with our fitness trainer, Jake Dean Taylor. He'll be back on. He was on 2 weeks ago. And he's got a great topic tomorrow for you. And then we're going to start it off with my interview with Alan Broca. Alan is writer and director of so many fantastic LGBT-themed-oriented films like Rick and Steve, the happiest gay couple in the world. He did all the Eating Out movies. He is bringing back Boy Culture, which he did back in 2006 with our good buddy Jason Caceres. So we talked to him, have a great conversation with him tomorrow. Then I'm really excited to bring Tyler Jean on. He is the founder of Functional Foods. Tyler is an actual doctor, boys and girls, and he has studied health and nutrition, has some great ideas in nutrition, eating, and what you should be doing for your body and everything. We have a great conversation tomorrow. So it's going to be a good show to end the week on with Friday Fitness Minute with Jake Dean Taylor, an interview with Alan Broca, and an interview with Tyler Jean, the founder of Functional Foods. So that's going to be a lot of fun for you. Remember that I do have the text number up if you want to text any last-minute questions. Tomorrow afternoon I'm going to be talking to Glenn from the Bravo show, which is going to be kind of very cool. And Camp Getaway is what it's called. I promise I'd tell you that again. And so we will have that. And then I'm going to be talking to Tommy Atkins from UK Singer. So it's going to be a kind of fun thing. You can text in if you have any questions for them. Thanks for tuning in, guys. I'm looking forward to tomorrow's show. I hope you guys enjoyed today's. Go ahead and download tomorrow and be sure to subscribe. Have a great evening. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.